previously on Nighthawks Podcast.
Let's just get into it. Let's give the people what they want. Record number of nominations. Did La La Land deserve it? Now, Cameron, I think you're probably going to come down in the pro column. So let's go with you.
Right into it, huh?
Does it deserve them? I think you've got to really look at where it's nominated in every individual category. There are some that I think maybe it was more deserving of than others in certain categories. I didn't dislike La La Land. I didn't love La La Land. It wasn't my favorite movie that's nominated for Best Picture this year.
But I thought it had the bones of something really good, but it got in its own way a little bit. And I really did not care for the vocal composition in the first two-thirds of it.
There are also, of course, three films that prominently tackle the issue of race in America in three different time periods.
And at least two of those films are in the right categories.
There is an emerging trend in the Academy of the film with the most nominations not actually going on to win Best Picture. I think I'm rooting for Moonlight, and I'm also picking Moonlight to win Best Picture.
I just do not get La La Land's entry into this. I thought the movie was a mess. I thought it was a visual mess. I thought it was put together poorly. Being the awards expert, I actually know what you're talking about when it comes to something about an EGOT.
I mean, I think you're right. It's a ridiculous term, EGOT.
Well, first off, what is the EGOT?
To win an EGOT is technically to win Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony.
My Echo is trying to buy an EGOT necklace on eBay because we said those things. I had to deactivate it in panic.
And the Academy Award for Best Picture.
You're impossible. Come on. La La Land.
We lost, by the way, but, you know.
Guys, I'm sorry. No.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won. Come on, this is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture.
Warren, what did you do?
Personally, I blame Steve Harvey for this.
KOKW calling. I'm on international frequency. Come in.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store, and he promised to do anything he can to help me to get to Texas.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of the Nighthawks Podcast, the cinema-centric podcast. For those of you kiddies out there who like to stay up a little later. But it's a podcast, so you can listen whenever the heck you want. Joining me, as always, in the cafe, our conceptual Nighthawks cafe with me, is my co-host, Matt Foster. Matt, how are you tonight?
I'm all right. I would say I'm at a 7 out of a possible 11.
I like that. Well, Matt, we have somebody joining us in the cafe today during normal operating hours. Joining us at our conceptual booth for coffee and pie tonight is the Nighthawks' Oscar Czar coming back for a command third performance and another bite at the Oscar apple. Cameron Maris, how are you?
Thank you, gentlemen. I'm doing pretty well. Thanks. It's good to be
and
here.
And I do believe you also, we've mentioned this before, but you do also have the dubious honor of being the one of the two musicians that is featured on virtually every episode of the Nighthawks podcast.
I've noticed it's less and less. The more creative you get with the show, the less and less my song or Chris's and my song appears in the show. But that's totally okay because I love hearing the episodes where it does appear. I always feel very proud to be a part of the show. And I love the episodes that it doesn't appear because that means something different is happening and we're listening to something else that is awesome, something that was curated from the brain of Trevor.
So, folks, it is the proverbial Oscar season. It is upon us. The awards night is just days away, counting from the night of this record. And so we figured if there was a chance to get our Oscar coverage out there, this is it. We're going to be talking about the 2018 Oscars. We're not going to get to the nominees just yet. We'll have our kind of our curated list of the groups that we want to talk about in our next episode. But as far as this episode goes, when last we left our intrepid heroes,
it was a crazy twist ending to last year's Oscars. I got to say, M. Night Shyamalan has nothing on the Oscar producers.
They're the best picture category. Kind of a hoot last year. Gentlemen, did you guys watch the Oscar telecast?
I did not. I am that cool.
Do you even own a TV, Matt?
You mean the monitor for my PS4?
Cameron, I know you were watching. I was watching. Tell us what happened.
I definitely was watching. Almost stopped watching, but I'm glad I didn't. Because to the viewer at home, what happened was Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway got up there to present Best Picture. And Warren Beatty opened the envelope and did a double take and then a triple take. And then Faye Dunaway took the envelope and read La La Land. Everyone applauds. Everyone assumes that La La Land has won. It was, in fact, the front
runner.
Now,
at this point, I am livid in a friend of mine's living room.
you were angry posting on Facebook is what you were doing.
Yes, yeah.
There was no reason to think that it wouldn't have been the winner. So when Faye Dunaway said La La Land, everyone assumed La La Land is the correct answer. So the producers from La La Land, the three producers get up there. They get through 1.5 of the producers' speeches before they say something is not right. Warren Beatty got back up there and Jimmy Kimmel, and they had the correct envelope this time, opened it, showed it to the crowd, and it said Moonlight, Best Picture.
This is where I kind of have to eat crow, is that I have to hand it to the La La Land guys that they handled this with grace and poise, and I don't know that it could have played any better than what it did. Because they were the ones that announced the mistake. They said, hey, there's been a mistake.
They were great about it. I remember them saying that they wanted their friends. You know, they'd become friends over the course of the awards season. They'd been at a ton of award shows and, you know, get-togethers and the, you know, the Oscar brunch and everything with these guys. And they wanted, you know, the truth to be told and their friends to be recognized. And I think they said about as much on stage. It was really, really gracious and totally shocking, though. And then so the producers of Moonlight got up and gave their speech. But it was absolutely nuts.
At what point, Trevor, did you start to calm down?
I think I threw some shade initially, kind of, you know, yeah, what up now? And then realized that that was actually super cool of the La La Land guys. And I kind of had to, like, take a step back and breathe and realize that, hey, these are all people, and that, you know, I'm getting wrapped up in the kind of team tribalism that comes with competitive races like this, and that I needed to slow down, take a step back, and breathe.
I just couldn't believe that it happened. I was just in shock that what was happening in front of my eyes. Nothing like that's ever happened, and crazy stuff has happened at the Academy Awards, but that is by far, hands down, the craziest thing that I've ever seen happen at the Oscars.
I think, of course, that Warren Beatty is a member of the Illuminati, and that's what was driving this.
Well, and I did feel a little bad for Warren Beatty, because everybody kind of gave him crap.
Well, kind of what's...
Because it's like, oh, he's a doddering old man, and you know, he read the wrong thing. No, he was given the wrong envelope. Like, he was kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, and
Yeah, it turned out to be something pretty a pretty dumb switcheroo, right?
What went on backstage was even more bizarre. So it turns out that there's always been two sets of envelopes, one on each wing, because they never know which side the stars are going to come up on. So they kind of check them off as they go through it, and so they always end up throwing one set away. Well, that's obviously a recipe for disaster, as we showed this year. When at the end, when there were two envelopes left, Best Actress and Best Picture, Emma Stone received one envelope, and the other envelope was mixed up because the accountant from PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is the accounting firm that the Academy hires to take care of these things, was busy, like, he was taking pictures of Emma Stone backstage when she exited off of his wing. So he just handed the wrong envelope to Warren Beatty. Really, it was just really the old switcheroo.
In the vein of updating you on things that we talked about last year, no EGOT race in the 2008 Oscar, or 2018 Oscars, rather.
But we're going to be talking about EGOT anyway.
Yeah, much to my consternation, we will be discussing EGOT. you'll remember that the EGOT, it's a four-round hat trick, basically, for entertainment. You've got the Emmy, the Grammy, the Oscar, and the Tony, and only an anointed few are the ones who actually have EGOT status. We talked about this at length in one of our Oscar episodes from last year, if you want to check that out. The update here is that a couple of fellas, Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, just recently won a Grammy for the Best Musical Theater Album for Dear Evan Hansen, which also won for Best Original Score and Best Musical Theater Album at last year's Tonys. With that Grammy and Tony win, along with their La La Land Oscar win last year, and with a potential win for their song This Is Me from The Greatest Showman, the pair just need one award to round out the EGOT, and that is the Emmy. And these are gentlemen who have been known to dabble in television. So, Cameron, this is actually kind of significant because they've pulled this off in a hurry.
Right. They've got the first three awards of the EGOT within a year of each other. They were the lyricists. They weren't the full songwriters. They were just the lyricists for the winning song from La La Land last year, our best original song, City of Stars. And this year, they are the composers and lyricists for the song This Is Me from The Greatest Showman. So they could double down and win two consecutive Academy Awards in the same category, which is always kind of cool. The thing now is, if they win an Emmy, anytime in the next 7 or 8 years, they will be the fastest EGOT in history. So they've got, I mean, because the fastest EGOT is, I think, 9 years it took Robert Lopez to complete. After he won Best Original Song for Frozen. So they could easily do it pretty fast. These guys are in high demand. They're doing the Disney movies now. They're doing all the Disney remakes. And they've also done television work before. I know they did some work on the CW. They wrote some original songs for those DC television shows like Supergirl and The Flash.
Yeah, they actually did the musical crossover episode.
And remember, even if they win a daytime Emmy, it counts.
Daytime counts.
Daytime counts. So they could do really anything. I mean,
now, correct me if I'm wrong, Cameron, just to bring the conversation full circle. Last year, when we were talking about Lin-Manuel Miranda getting an EGOT, which
right.
did not happen.
He did not complete the EGOT because he lost Oscar to these
at
guys.
At the time that he was being talked about, he was up for the quickest EGOT, wasn't he?
He would have been the fastest EGOT. He also would have been the youngest EGOT. I'm not really sure how old Pasek and Paul are, but I think that, I mean, they're pretty young guys, so they could possibly be that too. What they don't really care about the EGOT. What they care about, I think, is probably moving on and doing great work for their next project. I think they're getting, if I'm not mistaken, they're getting Guy Ritchie's Aladdin, and they're also getting.
Oh, wait, what?
Yeah, hang on.
I keep calling
that's
it
a thing?
Guy Ritchie's Aladdin. I'm going to always call it Guy Ritchie's Aladdin.
Yeah, that's happening. Guess who's playing the genie, Matt?
Jason Statham.
Close. So close.
It is, in fact, one Mr. William Smith. Wild Wild West, Jim West, Desperado,
Rough Rider. No, you don't want nada. None of this. I can see that.
Na-na-na-na-na-na, getting genie with it.
I remember when that would have been his kind of thing, you know. He can get back there.
I'm eager to see how it goes. All I want is for him to not try to be Robin Williams, and I think I'll be okay with it.
I don't know. I think he might be in trouble there.
Something original. I want him to do something original.
I want him to do nothing but things from Men in Black. Like, he just comes out in blue, and he's like, I make this look good.
If he only quotes other Will Smith characters.
He talks exclusively in pop culture references to himself.
Right, that he has already created.
All right, guys. Well, we talked a little bit about memorable Oscar moments, about how last year kind of rounded out. But Oscar is kind of known for a place to showcase kind of gonzo moments of history, especially during the telecast. And so we've bulleted a couple of these that we want to talk about. Cameron, when you reflect back on the Oscars, what are the moments that stand out to you?
I was a child of the 90s, so there's a lot of stuff that I remember when I was a kid, when I was going to movies and sort of growing up and kind of checking out movies and deciding what I liked and what I thought was cool. I got into the Academy Awards pretty young. When I think of Oscars, I think of Tom Hanks winning his back-to-back Best Actor Awards, and I remember thinking that was pretty amazing. He won in, I think, 93 and 94.
And that was for Forrest Gump and Philadelphia, respectively.
The other way around, though. Philadelphia first, and then Forrest Gump.
Well, I remember Philadelphia was a big thing. You know, that was before Tom Hanks was anointed as this, you know, great actor in Hollywood. He was just the kind of goofy guy that everybody liked, but crazy dramatic. The guy from Bosom Buddies is up for an Oscar this year, huh?
The guy from Big. Yeah.
Matt, are there any that stand out for you, the moments in the Oscars that I know you're not exactly an active spectator, but are there any moments that stand out to you as being like significant or things that you might have seen in hindsight?
I don't know. I'm trying to put together like my childhood award show montage.
I remember the Silence of the Lambs when I was pretty young. I remember the Silence of the Lambs winning almost everything and thinking that was really crazy because it was like a horror movie. It's actually really horror movie that has really won Best Picture, essentially.
And it's actually important to bring that up because genre film traditionally does not do well at the Oscars.
Right.
That being said, we have a horror picture that is up for several awards this year, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Actor. We can talk about that in the next episode, but it is worth mentioning that Silence of the Lambs being the one that kind of broke that trend.
Silence of the Lambs won. It's actually really notable in history because there are very few films that have won what they call the Big Five, which is Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and then one of the screenplay awards, so essentially Best Writing. I don't even know what rarefied company that's in. It's only a few movies that have ever won the Big Five, and Silence of the Lambs is one of them. It was just really, really overpowering that year, and I remember I was young enough during that Academy Awards that I had not seen Silence of the Lambs, and I remember watching the clips from Silence of the Lambs on the Oscars and being terrified. Like, I think I might have even had nightmares about it. Like, I was pretty young when Silence of the Lambs won Best Picture, but it really turned me on to that movie that I eventually watched when I was older. Probably turned me on to horror movies as a whole.
Yeah, see, that's what I have trouble remembering is, like, am I remembering when Silence of the Lambs was on the Oscars, or am I just remembering it, and it was, like, too long ago for me to, like, sort out? We never made a big deal at home about the Oscars, but I do remember the Silence of the Lambs marketing.
Well, and, like, I mean, there are just iconic moments in the Oscars that everybody knows about, like the streaker. The Oscar telecast got streaked one year. And it's not something that I remember, but I've certainly seen the clips afterwards and kind of understood it in pop culture. But Cameron, you were telling me that is actually kind of a tragic story.
It is kind of a tragic story, and it's also kind of maybe it's a heroic story, too. The gentleman who streaked the Oscars was an activist in San Francisco. He was actually a gay rights activist, and he was associated with Harvey Milk and that whole revolution that was happening in San Francisco. And he sort of became known after the Oscars streak for different acts of protest and things like that. He protested after Harvey Milk was assassinated. He was he had a business, and it was broken into, and he was killed, actually, tragically, just a few years after the Oscars. He was murdered. There's a documentary about him now that's out. I think it's called Uncle Bob.
This is something that Cameron and I actually kind of rediscovered this year. This was a little too early for us to have watched the Oscars, but there is an infamous Oscar telecast from 1989 that was just infamously bad. Cameron and I have been kind of watching clips from this just in talking about the Oscars. We stumbled on it this year. Specifically, there's two key moments here, and Cameron, you can talk about one, and I'll see if I can tackle the other. But Cameron, tell me a little bit about the Rob Lowe Snow White dance that took place in the 1989 Oscars.
Well, the 89 Oscars, I mean, the Oscars kind of always open with some kind of gag or like a song and dance number. Or in recent years, I guess they've been doing the cold open. Back in 89, it definitely was all about the song and dance, and I think they must have invited Snow White, the character, back to the Academy Awards. It must have been some kind of anniversary year or something. And there was an actress playing Snow White who was basically like the kind you would see at Disneyland, maybe, just like playing the Snow White princess. She's like invited back to the Oscars, and they introduced all these Oscar stars of the golden years to welcome her back. And then they brought Rob Lowe out and introduced him as her date, and they do a song and dance number. I mean, it's really schlocky. It's really, really bad. And it actually was sort of notorious for sinking the career of the producer that put all that together, that and the other musical number that is less well known. The other musical number, I think, is worse, but it's less well known.
I think it's much worse.
Well, people don't know about it because all they think about is Rob Lowe dancing with Snow White, which is notoriously bad, but man, the musical number that followed it was even worse. And all of this is available on YouTube, by the way. Just Google 1989 Oscars and you're going to get a treasure trove of terrible musical numbers and song and dance pieces.
Well, what blew my mind is watching these. If you watch that Rob Lowe intro, that's like, I don't know, 12 minutes. And then when you watch this other number,
it's 15 minutes long. It's a solid 15
minutes.
Yeah,
it's 15 minutes. It starts with an introduction by Walter Matthau, who gets up there and capers for a little bit, gets a little testy with the teleprompter operator, and then introduces Lucille Ball and Bob Hope.
Who do a whole routine.
Who introduce the musical number. Then what we get is the musical number called I Want to Be an Oscar Winner, featuring the Oscar winners of tomorrow.
The stars of tomorrow.
Hollywood did dare call their shot here.
Someday I'll be the one who walks up here accepting the prize.
And let's just see how many of these fine young men and women have won Oscars. We had in the lineup Keith Coogan, Patrick Dempsey, Corey
Grey's
Feldman,
Anatomy.
Jolie Fisher, Savion Glover, Trisha Lee Fisher, Kerry Hamilton.
Rest in peace.
Melora Hardin, Ricky Lake, Matt Latanzi, Chad Lowe, Tracy Nelson, Patrick O'Neill, Corey Parker, D.A. Pauly, Tyrone Power Jr., Holly Robinson Pete, Blair Underwood, and one Mr. Christian Slater, star of Pump Up the Volume.
The question is, Trevor, how many of them have been nominated for an Oscar? Zero. Since that disastrous curse of a production that you can once again watch on YouTube right now, 1989 Oscar Stars of Tomorrow, the song and dance number in which they announce that they're going to be future Oscar winners. I mean, of course, the song was written for them. You can't blame these like 20-year-old, 30-year-old young actors, singers, and dancers that they picked out of relatively small projects. But man, none of them have really had the careers that were predicted. And it's easy to see how they could have. Like, it's crazy because it's not that they're not talented people. They are certainly talented people. But my theory is that they just have a curse on their heads now after doing this ridiculous 15-minute song choreographed by Kenny Ortega. And actually, the song was written by Marvin Hamlisch and
John Ebb. Yeah, it was a Marvin Hamlisch song.
I mean, it's a good song, technically. The closest any of these actors have come to an Academy Award is Christian Slater did win a Golden Globe, but it was for television, so technically it's not really that close to an Oscar. Also, it should be noted, I did do a little bit more research, and Blair Underwood is halfway to an EGOT. He does not have the Oscar, though.
Huh.
Mm.
He has a Grammy and a Daytime Emmy.
Well, and I'll say this, out of that whole crew, Christian Slater, I think, probably has a strong potential to go Oscar.
I think he's got
I think he's got it in him. I am a Christian Slater booster. I think the guy is a good actor. He's one of those actors, though, that really flourishes when he's directed well. And so I can see Mr. Robot era Christian Slater pulling kind of a later in life.
Like a Michael Oscar. Keaton. Like a third
yeah,
act
like a
Michael
yeah,
Keaton
perfect example.
Oscar comeback.
And I think he was overlooked this year, 1989. I believe he was overlooked for one Pump Up the Volume. No, I take that back. That would have been the year following. I'm sorry.
Listen,
he probably got Pump Up the Volume because of the Oscar show.
We know what Christian Slater deserved an Oscar for, and it was Alone in the Dark. Hello?
The Uwe Boll epic film, Alone in the Dark.
I did get the Lord of the Rings tier. That was a good year for quote-unquote us.
Yeah, and that was, 2003, I think? And it was kind of the cumulative was the feeling. I don't know how you guys would cast it, but it was kind of the Lord of the Rings had been nominated and had been this juggernaut, but it had not really gotten a lot of awards love in the major categories until Return of the King came out, and it was kind of closing out the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Right. And then it won 11 out of 11. It's one of the only movies to win all of its awards. And in fact, it's the only one that had 10 or more nominations that won everything.
Well, and that was kind of a good moment for nerds. I mean, that's another example of a genre film doing exceptionally well at the Oscars and being kind of a treat for fans at home.
Right. Fantasy finally takes the top prize.
And just pin on to sort of bridge future and past here. I think it marked the first ascendance of Andy Serkis in public attention.
That's yeah, true.
He has two remarkable performances this year, one of them nominated for some Oscars.
Yeah, he's been awesome. I was actually just looking back today and looking to see, because I was thinking about how Andy Serkis needs to win an honorary Oscar, because what he does doesn't really fit into an existing Academy category very well. And I was just thinking, I was just looking at the list of the movies that have won visual effects awards for the actual visual effects Oscar specifically, that probably won because of, in part, their creation of his character. And the list is Lord of the Rings, Lord of the Rings, Lord of the Rings, and King Kong. All three Lord of the Rings movies, and then King Kong, all won Best Visual Effects, largely, in part, almost certainly, because of the work they did with Andy Serkis.
Those were mostly mocap performances. They were, you know, Andy Serkis got into a suit and then he was animated over.
Which is not to say their work wasn't excellent.
No, not at all.
What's really funny to me, though, is like right now, he's in kind of this second banana thug role in Black Panther. And it's not a part that will win an Oscar. But he's so, again, so physically transformed and so unlike himself that you can't help but go, wow, this guy, he's slept on. He's in a higher tier than people usually put him in.
And Cameron, you had a couple of Oscar upsets that you found were memorable.
Yeah, one of the most memorable things about the Academy Awards for me is when it goes to, when the Best Picture Prize goes to a movie that you weren't expecting or that everyone wasn't predicting. Like when Shakespeare in Love beat Saving Private Ryan, or Crash beating Brokeback Mountain, or The Hurt Locker beating Avatar.
I love that one, even though we don't love The Hurt Locker that much.
Well, you know, Matt and I are kind of a rare breed in that The Hurt Locker wasn't our favorite film.
I liked The Hurt Locker, but it's not my favorite movie. It certainly wasn't my favorite movie of that year.
But I will say, even though I'm not particularly warm on the Hurt Locker, it was a better film than Avatar.
I'll probably take it over Avatar, although I like both of them, to be fair.
I don't know. Like, the latter-day James Cameron kind of more Oscar-leaning fare is not my favorite. I'll take a Terminator 2. I'll take an Aliens. I'll take that era James Cameron. But Titanic kind of left me cold, and so did Avatar. They were okay. I'm not going to fault them at being bad movies, but they were definitely not my best pictures.
Avatar, I think, is simultaneously over and underrated because it was an incredibly innovative movie technically, and it did bring different mm-hmm. things to the screen that we had not seen. It was just as I walked across the street to my car, I got to about the line in the middle of the street and sort of bunched up and went, wait a minute, that was Fern Gully.
It's true. The story is pretty derivative of Fern Gully and Dances with Wolves
and Aliens. Like, it has mm-hmm. a lot of Aliens tropes right in it.
Are they
homages? Is that one of those things? Like, can you derivate yourself? Is derivative a verb?
Will we be able to answer that question when the next four Avatar movies that are scheduled to come out are finally released?
We maybe just aren't the people that Avatar resonated with the most, because I knew people that freaked out and cosplayed Avatar, you know, that really wanted to go there and live.
That's true.
I think one of the keys is something that I always kind of try to think about is the voters of the Academy, the members of the Academy, are filmmakers themselves. They are people who work in the industry. And when they see something innovative, they oftentimes will reward it, especially in the specific categories. Remember, the nominations are determined in each category by the members of that specific branch of the Academy. So cinematographers decide the five cinematography nominees. Art directors decide the art direction nominees. And so when you look at a movie like Avatar, you know, it was widely appreciated across many different fields of filmmaking, I think, because it was so innovative and it did so many things that artists and people who worked in the industry hadn't really seen before. And also, of course, I mean, the Academy rewards movies that do really well and do good things for the industry. And I think Avatar pushed the industry forward. So I think there was a lot of love for it. But, you know, once again, it didn't end up winning that many. I mean, it won a lot of technical awards, but it didn't win anything out of the top categories. Nothing, no headline categories or anything like that. It ended up actually going to James Cameron's ex-wife, Catherine Bigelow, for The Hurt Locker. Still the only woman to ever win the Academy Award for Best Director and the only woman to direct a Best Picture winner ever in 90 years.
So far. We do have a candidate for this year, but we'll talk about that in the next episode. So, okay, Cameron, I do want to talk a little bit about Oscar mechanics and how this works. We have kind of had an ongoing conversation here in the diner about the Oscar makeup and kind of what the Academy is demographically and how that works and what the politics behind that are. The first Oscar coverage episode that we had was the year that hashtag OscarSoWhite started trending. Cameron, how are we? Are we still hashtag OscarSoWhite?
Well, Oscar's still pretty white. Progress is slow. The arc of the moral universe, as they say. I think that there are improvements that have been made, and I think it's not only because of the changes that have been made to the Academy makeup itself, but it's certainly almost because everyone's way more, how shall we put, everyone's getting more woke about it, you know? Everyone's looking for more diverse statements from artists, looking for more diverse creators, and looking for a greater variety of voices, I think, out there. And I think that that's reflected in this year's nominees. I know we're going to talk about these a little bit later. We are seeing a greater representation, I think, of artists of color and actors of color, and there are more women nominated this year than ever before. It's still a lower percentage than it could be, but I think progress is being made.
Cameron, can you give us a little breakdown of kind of how things have changed demographically over the last 2 years?
Sure.
He said, setting up this question like he knows that you have an answer.
I do have an answer. Well, OscarSoWhite first started trending in 2015. So there was a study done about the Academy by the Los Angeles Times in February of 2012. They published the study that sampled over 5,000 of the then 5,765 members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So most of them, the wide majority of them. The study found that the Academy makeup at that time, 94% white, 77% male,
shocker,
and 86% age 50 or over, with the median age of 62 years old.
None of that surprises me.
Right. 94% white is shocking to me, though. Like, I mean, I think any statistic that is over 90% is clearly something's wrong. There's clearly something. So 94% white, that was shocking to me. 86% age 50 plus, that is less shocking. But also the study found that a third of the members of the Academy were previous winners or nominees of the Academy Awards themselves. So what that shows is it was a really closed off group that essentially controlled its own membership. And it still, of course, is a closed off group that controls its own membership. But yeah. it's sort of, what would you call it? A circle jerk?
Yeah, I think we can keep that in.
Can
judges?
I say that?
I'll judges? Allow it.
Circle jerk? All right, you'll allow it. Circle jerk is not a bleepable offense.
Wonderful. Circle
Matt,
jerk.
Matt, did you just want to get one in? Did you just want to say it one time?
What, circle jerk?
Yeah, there we go.
Ah, it's a secret word.
I'm screaming, everybody.
So one thing that we didn't really get to is the changes that were made after Oscar So White, after those really dismal percentages, those really dismal statistics that I read. There are some slightly less dismal statistics after the 2015 and 2016 Oscars campaign. In June of 2016, the Academy announced that they were introducing a new class into the ranks of the Academy. I think it was one of the larger classes ever. 683 new members. That's like a 10%. Over 10%, probably, I think, 15% increase in membership. That new class was comprised of 46% women and 41% people of color.
Okay, so that's right around half and half on both, which is better, but still not great. However, what did that do to the overall makeup?
As of 2016, the 6,000-plus members of the Academy, whose roster is a closely guarded secret, reported numbers of being 89% white and 73% male. That's, of course, down from 94% and 77%, respectively. So, in just a couple of years, that's a pretty big shift when you're talking about a group of people that is 6,000 plus in number. The Academy has committed to, quote, double the number of women and minorities in the Academy by the year 2020. So not only have they continued to grow those numbers, but they've continued to making a commitment to continue growing those numbers and being more representative of a more diverse constituency, really.
Okay, so I guess the short answer here, or the short question here is it working?
I think yes, but slowly. I think that you've got more nominees this year that represent a better diversity of stories and viewpoints and perspectives. You've got the first female cinematographer ever nominated this year. You've got the fifth woman ever to be nominated for Best Director, the fifth African-American ever to be nominated for Best Director, and the fifth Latin-American ever to be nominated for Best Director, all in the same year.
In a three-way head-to-head slobber knocker battle.
Exactly.
Just the nomination of Get Out, which is, I don't know if it's brand new ground.
I think it's brand new ground in the Best Picture race.
Yeah,
because sure.
It's horror. It is horror, by the way. Who was it, the Golden Globes? Put it up as a comedy?
Yeah, it was in the comedy or musical category at the Golden Globes, which I think was super unfortunate. Like, talk about a total misread of where that movie belongs. I mean, I think that they just saw that it was satire, like in a broad sense, put it in comedy because they associated satire with comedy. The Hollywood Foreign Press are ridiculous. They're just ridiculous.
You know, little Rel Howery had some good laugh lines in there. That the TSA agent character is a great moment of levity in Get Out, but I would not go so far as to call it a comedy. I would call it a horror movie with some really good laugh lines in it.
Right, it's a social commentary satire, but it's not like a broad satire.
Well, and that's the thing, is we're looking at a black-helmed, black-created, black-featured movie that is very open and bald about its politics and what it's trying to say. I mean, this is not a thinly veiled criticism. So, that to me is why it's kind of standing out. On top of the fact that it is just a good horror movie, and I would love to see it do something just so we can get one more in there with Silence of the Lambs. But, I mean, there is a lot more going on there, too.
Yeah, and then you have also the other one, for odd reasons, Shape of Water is like a diversity dark horse. And not just because of necessarily the naked allegory to be drawn from the main plot, but the setting and the supporting cast and the implication that these themes have always existed. I always appreciate that when someone looks back on the past and goes, you know, like the Pleasantville paradox, like this stuff was, it was never true. It was never vanilla, you know? So I think that's an interesting nomination that hints that there's, the times actually are kind of a changing.
Well, yeah, and that's, I do think that we have a great pool this year. Well, I'm using pool probably in a poor place, but we do have a great contest this year. And we'll talk about that a little more when we get granular on the nominees and kind of what's going on in the next episode. But in the meantime, Cameron, when you are creating your Oscar pool, which is to say trying to pick your head bets when filling out their own ballot at home, what are some of the things that they can do to, you know, maybe give themselves a bit of an edge?
Sort of the website that has become the official unofficial odds makers of the pool of experts on the internet is a site called Gold Derby. I don't know what other website I would compare it to, but users and experts and all sorts of people can weigh in as to what their predictions of the Oscars are, and it sort of compiles everything and allows you to take a look at everything and actually uses those some certain metrics to give odds. So it's sort of the odds maker website. If you're going to put money on the Oscars, that's probably where you're going to want to go to take a look at what the odds on the movies are. But, you know, there are
not
always
surprises.
Not that
we condone illegal gambling activities. We're prohibited. Just
put it I condone the shit out of them. Break stupid laws. Break one every day.
Only where when they don't notice. No, but I think that there are always surprises. You got to look at the history, at the politics of the year, at the precursor awards that have happened. You know, I think that one of the important things to think about, especially with Best Picture, ever since we expanded to anywhere between 5 and 10 Best Picture nominees in any given year, there's sort of a new way that they vote on Best Picture. It's actually a tiered ballot when you're voting for the Best Picture winner. And this is something that you were talking
about. Yeah, this was really interesting. Honestly, now that I know that this is how this is going to go down, a lot of those weird Oscar upsets and a lot of the political votes, like, it makes so much more sense now that I understand how the voting on Best Picture works.
Well, it really has changed the way Best Picture is tabulated. I mean, it really has changed the mathematics of the situation. And so I think that that's what's led to the separation between Best Picture and Best Director, the director-picture split, as it were, which basically means in the old days, like when I was a kid, you could basically pick Best Director based on whoever the Best Picture frontrunner was because they almost always matched up. Nowadays, it's not the case. You've got 5 out of the last 6 years, Best Picture and Best Director have gone to different movies. Ever since we've gone to this new system, sort of the modern system, it's really changed the way people look at it, and it's changed the way we tabulate Best Picture.
So can you explain a little bit about how it works, Cam?
Sure. It's like if you have only one movie that you think is the Best Picture, you can vote for one, or you can vote for two. Or you can vote for 3. You can vote for as many as you want, up to, of course, 9, because that's how many nominees there are. But you must rank them. So it's a tiered ballot. Basically, what happens is they calculate everyone's favorites based on their ranking. They throw out the bottom 4. Then using the top 5, whatever movie appears most regularly in the highest position is going to be the Best Picture winner. So the way to look at it really is, Trevor, let's say your number one is Get Out and your number two is Dunkirk. Matt, let's say...
Okay, I'm into that.
Matt, let's say your number one is Three Billboards and your number two is Dunkirk. Let's say my number one is Lady Bird and my number two is Dunkirk. Now, that's just for an example. Out of the three of us, the calculated winner is going to be Dunkirk. Even though it was none of our favorite movie, it was the one that we all agree is the highest ranked out of those choices.
Huh.
So
it's like kind of it's an instant runoff system kind of.
Exactly. Very different than just a simple democracy vote for your favorite. Pretty complex, and I think it leads to situations like last year, for instance, Moonlight beating La La Land.
And see, and I'm not sure how I feel about it, but man, like, the headcanon moments that I've thought about over the last couple of years, just the, like, how does this work? How does this happen? Both good and bad.
I think that it can lead to shocking...
It makes so much more sense now that the person, or that the film who got the most second place votes could, in fact, be the best picture of the year.
Right.
You know, just to borrow from your example.
It can lead to totally left field choices, and it can lead to really boring vanilla choices, you know? Kind of like, well, it was the one that kind of everyone thought was good enough, you know, to be considered in the top five. But it can also lead to really weird left field choices that are sort of cult movies like Get Out. I mean, not that Get Out is a cult movie necessarily, but it's certainly a movie that is the number one movie of a certain contingent. And it might be the one that everyone kind of agrees is good enough to be in the top five, even if it's not your number one. It could happen.
All right. Well, kind of wrapping things up for this episode, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, things that since the Oscars are undergoing this weird dynamic change in more ways than one, in more directions, in more places, things that we would like to see changed maybe about the Oscars in the future. I picked a couple of examples, and I think, Cameron, you might have a few. Matt, I'm not sure if you do. But, for example, I want to say, let's go to hell with this Sunday night jazz. Let's not do this on Sunday night anymore. The Oscars, Cameron and I were talking about what the average length of an Oscar telecast is, and they've been quickly approaching 4 hours. I'm sorry, but, I'm an adult now, and I need to sleep. And I am not fresh Monday morning after any given Oscars just because I'm old and cranky. But, let's move this to a Saturday night thing. Let's
Saturday night Oscars?
Saturday night Oscars. We'll make it more of a party atmosphere. You know what I would actually like to? I'd like to see the Oscars held at, like, this kind of weird hedonistic, just out in the middle of the desert. We have Burning Man set up around a theater, and inside the theater is where, like, the posh, beautiful people get to play, and then outside is just, like, the hedonistic, just, like, Mad Max. I want that out there. I think we could really rebrand the Oscars and make it more appealing. That's just me.
I'm on board.
I'd also like to see an award, and this goes back to the conversation we were having earlier, based on special effects characterization.
Right.
Specifically awarded to mocap operators and animators. Not a best performance, because if you look at the categories, it's not who is best supporting actor. It is who is the best actor in a supporting role.
Right. It's actually the best performance by an actor in a supporting role.
This would be a character-based award where they award it not on performance but on best characterization, which would allow you to include animators and team members and maybe an Andy Serkis or somebody in there.
So you could award the person who performed the motion capture as well as the people who created the character?
In this example, if you were going to go with the current Planet of the Apes film, you would nominate Caesar in Planet of the Apes, and then the award would go to... I don't know, the Academy would have to decide who they would want it to go to, but that way you can potentially have a team award, like a special effects award, where it's going to multiple people. But,
that would be pretty cool.
You know, we could get one for Andy Serkis, one for the lead animator, one for the head character designer, whatever. I think that's the way to do that. I've kind of tried to wrap my head around how you would get Andy Serkis into a regular category for some of his digital work, and I think that's going to be it. And then, of course, the age-old discussion of let's get a stunt award. That one's getting weirder and grayer, because what is a stunt and what is digital, and, you know, how in the digital realm are stunts? things like that. But I think it's time that we have maybe a stunt coordination or a best overall stunts in a film category, just so we can get that area of Hollywood a little bit of
I seriously can't believe there's not
that
one.
Would be great.
Seems like a miscarriage.
It's a crime. Yeah,
miscarriage of justice, you know?
Absolutely. There are people who have worked for many, many years in Hollywood and done some of the coolest stuff that we've ever seen on film of any of the artists working in some of these movies, and they've never gotten the kind of recognition that other people have.
Well, and the other thing that, like, I mean, I almost feel tacky bringing it up, but it has to be said. I don't care if it's Daniel Day-Lewis. Not many people acted themselves to death. These are people that literally sacrificed their health to make movies look better, and the credit they get is literally just something that zips by on the screen.
Cameron, did you have anything that you wanted to change about the Oscars?
I totally agree on those two categories, and that's actually the categories that I shortlisted as well as along with one other one. I think that there should be, and there should have been for a long time, best original soundtrack category. I'm not sure if you would have to do it two categories, like one for curated soundtrack and one for original soundtrack, like original songs, or if you could do some kind of just a combination general soundtrack award. But I think that'd be great, especially because there are so many more original soundtracks that are being made, as in all original music or mostly original music, as far as songs being added to movies. And those aren't necessarily qualified for the original score category, which is the general music award for a film. And of course, there's original song, but that only awards one song, and it rewards the songwriters only. I'm specifically thinking about things like the Black Panther soundtrack for Kendrick Lamar. It's such an amazing soundtrack, and it's a piece of art in and of itself. And then there are other things like the Daft Punk soundtrack for Tron. Completely original, but it didn't necessarily qualify for the score, the best original score Oscar.
The Man with the Iron Fist comes to mind.
Yeah, good one. Kill Bill. You know, either of those two soundtracks.
Curated soundtracks like any Tarantino movie, really.
Yeah, not a bad idea. Now, you also, Cameron, have talked about splitting the categories for the performance.
Well, it's one thing, you know, I rag on the Golden Globes because I think, you know, the Hollywood Foreign Press is pretty, as I said before, ridiculous. But one thing that I do kind of like is that they split the acting categories in half. So they have a best actor in a drama and a best actor in a comedy or musical. Now, I think we can do better than that. I think the musical part of that's ridiculous. Best actor in a comedy.
Well, that
best
comes
actor
from a different time. That's
right. Totally.
That's a holdover.
So, you know, you end up slotting actors in weird spots because of that, I think. I like the idea of separating comedy and drama. And I think that it gives you an opportunity to recognize more films and more performers. One actress that people have been talking about this year is Tiffany Haddish. She was in a movie called Girls Trip, and she's sort of she's becoming a real cult favorite right now on the internet. She's a big personality, and she got a Golden Globe nomination, but not an Oscar nomination because she was in a comedy, and she is a woman of color. And I think splitting up the acting categories like that would give us a good opportunity to recognize some actors who, you know, spend their entire careers giving great performances, but never get the kind of recognition from the Academy because they make comedies.
Yeah, why couldn't we have given Tom Hanks an Oscar for Turner and Hooch?
She was also really good in Keanu, where she was the love interest. Didn't you guys watch that with the little kitty? Oh, you're missing out, man. We're gonna have a Keanu night.
That is
coming
Jordan
soon
Peele
on the Nighthawks podcast.
That's Jordan Peele pre Get Out.
Yeah, strangely worth mentioning.
They did write that screenplay, I believe.
Yeah. It was the movie that caused me to know, when I heard the buzz about Get Out, that it would be credible, that it wasn't going to be a comedy. There's enough serious action and serious portrayal in Keanu, as silly as the idea is, that I was like, if he's making a horror movie, it's going to be a horror movie. I was completely confident in them when I heard they were making that.
Yeah, Keanu surprised me. It was much better than I thought it was going
to
be.
All right, Matt. Well, to round us out, is there anything you'd like to see changed in the Oscar arena?
I fully agree. I don't know if it needs to be shorter, but something's got to change for that 4 hours. I mean, I can't. I have trouble watching the whole telecast.
Everyone
I would
does.
Agree with you about tuning something there. And I don't know, man. I think I would almost like to see, like, this is a good thing to bet and handicap and will they ever. Why are the Oscars still on television?
Yeah, that's a
when question. Are we going to get an award show that just goes off channel, that just goes Netflix or...
That's a good question, because, yeah.
I don't know. ABC has the contract now. I'm curious to see if that contract ever becomes available, if Netflix would make a play for it. Of course, it's hard for Netflix to do live events, isn't it?
No, and that's the thing. Just recently, Amazon Prime started carrying football games.
Well, there you go.
I mean, like, yeah, this stuff is starting to happen. The rats fleeing the ship of appointment television are happening, and I think it's just a matter of, I hate to be so crass and cold, but I think it's just a matter of the age demographic for that medium aging out.
Yeah, I'll be pulling out the old antenna to watch it this year.
Yeah, I've got to find a place to watch it myself. But yeah, it's just, I agree. I think it's due. It's going to happen. It's just a matter of when and how it works. Yeah, I'd love to watch Hedonistic Mad Max pre-party red carpet. A shorter telecast that takes place in the inner sanctum with the beautiful people.
Right.
I think we can achieve that shorter telecast by going hostless.
Ooh.
I'm done with Oscar hosts. I don't want to do it anymore. We have done it historically that way before. And even if you look at examples like the Golden Globes, the phenomenon for a host in that awards ceremony is actually quite new. And I think it's because they want to turn it into more of this variety show type of thing. I look at the Rob Lowe Dancing with Snow White, and I look at the future Oscar winners of tomorrow, and I'm like, that right there represents half an hour of that program between those two musical numbers. To the point where, famously, the 1989 Oscars did not feature musical performances by the nominees for Best Song or Best Score. Instead, we got these song and dance numbers, and I would rather get performances of the art that we're there to celebrate. And as much as I do love Billy Crystal mugging in some kind of, you know, weird movie parody, it's not something that I'm tuning in to see year after year.
I absolutely agree.
100%. I want to know who the best picture is. I'm not here for the show.
Well, and I want to see performances of all five nominated songs, damn it.
Yeah, and that's another thing, that they just seem to just do that to cut for time, but a lot of times we don't get that.
When they make those artists do a medley, I get so angry. Like when they nominate five songs as being the five best songs from motion pictures of the year, and then they make them do a 3-minute medley all together on stage, that's so insulting to music as an art form. I mean, it's so insulting to the artists, like to make them mash up their work with the people they're nominated against. Just let them perform the songs. Sometimes he can't because, you know, Eminem didn't attend the Oscars when he won for Lose Yourself from 8 Mile.
So folks, I think that's about going to wrap it up for this episode of our Oscar coverage. Stay tuned for our other episode of Oscar coverage,
part two,
coming up, where we're going to get down to the real granular details on this year's Oscars, including your nominees and categories. And look forward to hearing from you then. Any final thoughts, gentlemen?
I think I'm thoughtless. I think I'm tapped out. All my thoughts are for next episode.
Yeah, I've got thoughts brewing for next episode, too.
All right. Well, in the meantime, I guess we're going to sign off to have some coffee and pie, and then we're going to sign immediately back on and do this again. So stay tuned.
Hello. I want to tell you what happened. I opened the envelope, and it said, Emma Stone, La La Land. That's why I took such a long look at Faye and at you. I wasn't trying to be funny.
From a white oak tree, people sitting on porches, thinking how things used to be. Dark night. It's a dark night. Dark night. It's a dark night.
Dark night.
some new way.